Tim H. from Louisville, Kentucky. I haven't known Tim long. We met yesterday, and yet I know he has a great program, and I'm looking forward to his talk. I do have some information I can share. He starred for the St. Louis University Billikens basketball team in his college days. He's a successful businessman, owns his own business. He's the father of two sons and a daughter, and a grandfather, six kids. And one way that I know that Tim has a great program is that we had a serene drive yesterday from Hartsfield International Airport to this hotel in Atlanta rush hour traffic. So will you please give Tim H. a warm Georgia welcome.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Heil, and I'm an alcoholic. Since April the 12th of 1990, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol or other mood-altering substance to live in this world. And that's been absolutely, positively the best thing that's ever happened to me. And so happy to be here. And you're right. You know, coming from that airport is something else. And I'm glad I wore my spring tie, my spring coat. My readers look like a bunch of undertakers up here with me. Say, come on, guys, pep it up a little bit here. Friday night. You're looking good, though. You're looking good. No, I'm just kidding. I'm very, very excited about being here, and I want to thank the committee for asking me, Susan and Charles, the taper, who I think initially suggested that I come, and certainly Tom for picking me up and getting me here, and everybody I've already met. I've already had a ball. I played in the golf thing this morning, and my group's right over here. We did really well. We were 2 under, and we thought we were really something else, being nobody had a handicap less than 20. Now, that group with 59, I don't know about that. Somebody mumbled something about rigor, self-honesty. I don't know. No, we had some good golfers out there, and it was a good time, and I really appreciate it. And I really enjoy being here. I tell you what, you've got a great weekend in store. You know, I know a lot of the speakers that are coming up, and I'm telling you, it's like the Woodstock of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I feel like the garage band is doing the warm-up here. I mean, you've got some heavy-duty sobriety speaking here this weekend, and that tells me it's really quite a quality environment, and I can tell that, you know, we've already had some great, great meetings. I got to come to the 5:30 meeting here and met some people and heard what I needed to hear. You know, I'm always at home in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter where I'm at. And, you know, celebrate the miracle. What a wonderful, wonderful theme for this weekend, because, you know, that's what it's all about. You know, in fact, I really believe this. You know, my opinion is, someday, you know, historians will look back on Alcoholics Anonymous as the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th and 21st century. I really believe that. You know, the world doesn't know that, but we do, and that's all that really counts, and that's why we show up here. You know, I was in Phoenix, Arizona last week for a business thing, and, you know, it was a business thing with those people. And I told Tom when I called, I said, man, I can't wait to get to Atlanta with my people, you know. And if you've been around for a while, you know what that means. You know, you just know wherever you show up, there you are. And, you know, you talk about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this week, you know, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. We've got a New Yorker with us. You know, we've got someone coming from Florida. We've got someone coming from Colorado. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is so broad and so big. You know, it's opened up my world so, so, so big. In fact, I think, you know, the reason I'm here, Charles heard a tape that I did at Cherokee, North Carolina. It was on a Cherokee Indian reservation. You know, and you talk about a neat deal. Here I am, you know, 6'4" tall, white guy. I'm looking out there, and there's all these Indians sitting out there. You know, the chief sitting right down here in front of me, and I was a little nervous, you know. I didn't know really what to say, so I copped out. I said, you know, I told him, I said, you know what, when I was a kid, and I used to watch those Cowboys and Indians movies, I pulled for the Indians. They all laughed, and they knew I was a drunk too. You know, and I guess more than anything, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, we were talking at the 5:30 meeting tonight about, you know, a young man showed up 89 days sober and that he didn't want to come and the hesitancy about taking that next step. You know, and my world was so small, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family in Louisville, Kentucky. And my daddy was one of these guys. I remember he told me one time, listen to this, you know, I'm Irish Catholic from Kentucky. He said, Tim, there's only three things you need to know about living in this world, and here they are. Football, you pull for Notre Dame. Basketball, you pull for Kentucky, and you vote the straight Democratic ticket. That's it, kid. Now get out there and live, you know. You know, what I'm saying is that's a pretty small world, you know. But by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, April 12th of 1990, you know, that world had gotten even smaller because it was all down to me. You know, and I guess that's what it took to get me here. But, you know, I say that because my world today is so big, so big. I've been so many places as a result of this thing called sobriety, you know, so many places. The Indian Reservation. You know, I remember one time I spoke up in Ohio when it was all these bikers, you know, and I'm up here in my Tommy Hilfiger shirt. I'm thinking these guys are going to kill me when I'm done, you know. And after I was finished, this one guy had all his leathers on named Spike, and he came up and grabbed me and hugged me and said, I love you, man. Yeah. You know, and only in AA, you know, does that happen. You know, I like to share this little story. My home group is in the inner city, downtown Louisville, and it just ended up that that's where I got sober. And it's 3 days a week during the day, and it's a lot of people that come from the treatment centers. And because it's in the inner city, probably, you know, 90% of the crowd is African-American, is black. And probably of all the guys I sponsor, probably 80% of them are black guys. Well, about a year ago, I was down in that way downtown, and I was going down a one-way street, and this black gentleman behind me and his wife plowed into me. You know, and he was, you know how it happens with an accident. We were kind of awkward and standing there exchanging cards, standing in the middle of the street, you know, in this not-so-good neighborhood, you know, but very close to my home group. And about that time, here comes two guys down the side of the street, you know, both black. And they come run over to me and go, hey, Tim, you okay? You okay? How you doing, man? You all right? I go, I'm okay, guys. I'm okay. They took off. We're standing there, me and this old guy. And about two minutes later, here comes two other guys, both black. You know, they run over to me. Tim, you okay? How you doing, man? You all right? They take off. About that time, car comes off the expressway. Got four guys in it, all black. You know, they stop the car and jump out. Tim, are you okay, man? You okay? They take off, you know. I turn around, this poor old black gentleman sitting there, and he goes, who are you anyway? I want to say, man, I'm just a drunk, you know. I don't know what to tell you. You know. And that only happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. You know, I was about 6 months sober. And I had my business back, and I was out making my sales calls one day. And, of course, I hadn't told anybody I was sober, as if they didn't know in my office. But anyway, this one particular day, and, you know, you guys told me to meet a lot of guys, and I did. And I got their phone numbers and started calling them. And so one day I was out making my phone calls, and I called into the office. I said, well, Tammy, give me my messages. And she said, all right, Tim, here they are. She said, Jim called, and he said, thanks for last night. Said Tom called and said, could he get together with you tonight? Jim called and said, could he have lunch with you? And then she said, and there's one more. I said, well, go ahead and read it. She said, well, Stan called, Tim. He just wanted to tell you that, well, he loves you. And I said, hey, look, Tammy, when I get in there, we need to have a talk. You know what? And I went in that day. But here's how it works, you know. I went in that day and I told her my story. You know, she was the first person outside Alcoholics Anonymous I told my story. As it turned out, she had a daddy who was an alcoholic and she had a husband who was well on the way, you know. And what I've learned is that God, as it tells us in our book, if we stay on the firing line of life, then God gives us a chance to carry this very, very important message, you know. And I'm very, very grateful for that. You know, I have a very good life today and I'll talk about that. But let me talk about how I got there. You know, let me talk. I know there's a lot of new people here, I can tell you. And I was in the 5:30 meeting, and that's so neat. That's what these things are all about. I know this is the first conference for a lot of people. I was sharing in the 5:30 meeting. You know, it was 5 years sober before I went to a conference. You know, that was a bold move as far as I was concerned. You know, but when I came, let me tell you what happened to me, because I heard Mark was sharing in the 5:30 meeting about listening to Liz's story. And although they were two different people, he identified not with what she did, really, but how she felt. You know, and I have to tell you, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I was new and I sit out there with the way you all are tonight, I would listen to the speaker. And honestly, what I did in my mind, I would think what I did and what I didn't do that you were talking about. You know, so I would sit there and I'd be thinking, well, I did that, didn't do that, did not do that. You know, next night, next speaker, didn't do it. I mean, the didn'ts were huge, you know, because I thought, I get enough didn'ts, I'm out of here, you know. I'm doing this night after night after night. I go to this meeting and a lady is speaking, you know, kind of snuck up on me, and I'm listening to her story, and everything this woman did, I did. You know, I'm thinking, well, I did that. Oh my God, I'm getting desperate, and I did that. Right at the end of her story, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, I did not do that. I told some old guy about that. He said, sound like you're getting a little desperate there to me, Tim. And I say that because when I got here, I didn't know what an alcoholic looked like. And you guys said, well, kind of like you. I said, no, you know what I mean, dirty old man in a raincoat. And they said, no, we don't know what you mean. And you know what? It was confusing, just like it is tonight. Because I looked around, there were people dressed well, or people smiling, people having a good time for the most part, you know, and I couldn't tell you were drunk by looking at you. But here's what happened to me, because, you know, I listened to, and what happened to you was all over the board. Some people lost this, some lost that, some didn't seem to lose too much. But here's what grabbed me. I kept listening to the stories, and no matter what the circumstances were, people were talking about three things that I heard. They were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontent. They were talking about being apart from, not a part of, and they were talking about progressive patterns of dishonesty in their life. Man, and when I heard those three things, I couldn't escape. You know, I could not escape, because those three things have been part of my life from the get-go. Those three things are the things that have kicked my little rear end for the last 16 years in this program. You know, restless, irritable, and discontent. Our book talks about it. What is it? I don't know. I just got it. Yeah. Wake up with it, you know. Sometimes the most powerful thing I hear anybody in the AA meeting share is something like, hey, Joe, how's it going? And Joe says, I don't know, Tim. God, I don't know. Tim, you know, I've got this feeling, Tim. Do you know Tim? I go, yeah, I know, man. I know what that is. See, because whatever that was, I put alcohol in it when I was 12 years old, and it took it away. And I never forgot that, and I chased that, you know, for the next 27 years is what I did. Apart from, not a part of. You know, you hear a lot of us talking about that. And I think that's the part we were talking about in the 5:30 meeting. There's a part of me that always wants to separate from the pack. There's a part of me that always wants to pull away, you know. And even 16 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's crazy sometimes. As good as it's been to me, this crazy little thought will come that, no, you know, you don't belong here. You're just a little bit different, Tim, you know. I was back in the 80s, you know, and I tell you this because I watched a lot of movies with my grandkids today. There's one movie I love. It's called E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Remember that movie when it came out in the 80s? And back in the 80s, I was out ramping around. I was with this woman who I think I was engaged to, you know, that type of thing. And anyway, I remember we went to that movie, and I was about half loaded. And there's a part in the movie, if you remember, where O.E.T., he gets all green and gray and crinkly. He's drying up. No, he's dying, man. He's dying. But all of a sudden, he looks up in the sky and he goes, home, E.T., home. Man, I just had tears coming down my face. And this girl I was with looked at me and said, what is wrong with you? I said, I know just how he feels. And I'm guessing some of you know how he felt too. You know what? Because I can tell that same story in my church. Nobody gets it. Only in AA. So restless, irritable, and discontent, apart from, not a part of. And the last thing was the progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. You know, and what I will tell you that I discovered is I lied if the truth was good enough. Let me say that again. I lied if the truth was good enough. You know, I remember as a kid, I used to think about this a lot. You know, I was a pretty good athlete. So if I scored 20 points in the basketball game, I came home, you'd say, how many did you score? I'd say 24. You know, got a B on the test. What'd you get? B plus. You know, and I remember thinking, why do you do that, Tim? Why is not the truth good enough? You know, and I don't know what that is, but I know something about the 12 steps. And I know the whole journey for me is learning, been learning that the truth is good enough. And that I have to live by it to stay sober and grow in this program. You know, I tell this little story. I guess I was about 3 months sober and I got back with my family. And I had a 13-year-old daughter at the time. And she was staying up late, and I was staying up late because I couldn't sleep. And we were watching, 12:45 in the morning, watching the late show. And she says to me, "Hey, Dad, can I order a pizza?" And I said, "Oh, honey, you better not do that. Your mother will go nuts." She said, "All right, come on, let me." I said, "All right, go ahead." You know. So she orders the pizza, 1:15 in the morning, doorbell rings, it's pizza man. My wife comes storming out of the bedroom, starts screaming at my daughter, "What are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning?" And my daughter said, "Well, Dad said I could." My wife said, "Did you say she could?" I said, "No." And my daughter said, "Dad, you're lying." I said, "I know what I do it all the time." Yeah, try calling your sponsor at 1:30 in the morning and tell them you just lied about a pepperoni pizza. You know, that didn't go well. But I say all that to say this, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent, apart from, not a part of, and patterns of dishonesty in my life. What I know today is that what the 12 steps were constructed to help me with. That is my program of recovery. Because see, what they told me is, guess what, Tim? When you stop drinking, restless, irritable, and discontent is still going to be there. And you're going to have to learn a new technique, a new way of living to deal with that. Because that's all you've ever known. And this whole idea about being a part of, you know. Let me tell you, I go back to when I was about 5 years sober. You know, the thing that I've always fascinated me and scares me a little bit in the big book they call talk about the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink, you know. And here's what I can tell you about it. The only thing I know about it for sure is I can always see it in you and hear it in you, but I can never see it or hear it in me. And the reason I'm bringing that up is then I better stay here. When I was about 5 years sober, see if you can relate to this. If you were around me when I was back at that time, what you were hearing me saying would be things like, "Well, that sponsor I've had, you know, he was okay for a while, but he's getting a little goofy. I might have to get me a new one. And that home group, oh, God, you know, they're doing the dumbest things. I'm going to have to change. And for gosh sakes, the people they're letting in Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, the caliber's way down." That's what you're hearing me say. But you know what was really happening? I was starting to back out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And thank God the old timers around me, you know, they could hear the peculiar mental twist in me. And they'd say things to me like, "Oh, Tim, don't worry about that sponsor of yours. He just might make it. I mean, he's only 23 years sober, you know." "And Tim, you know, don't worry about your home group. What size was it when you started?" "Well, we had about 20 people." "How many are in there now?" "Well, about 150. "And Tim, don't worry about the caliber of drunks they're letting in AA. They let you in, didn't they?" Yeah. You know, and I say that very seriously because you know what? If you work with a lot of people, if you sponsor a lot of people, you can hear the peculiar mental twist. And it starts off like things like, "Well, no, I can't make the meeting, Tim, because, you know, I'm coaching Little League." Or, "No, my girlfriend's doing something different. I got to spend time with her. You understand that?" You know, it's subtle. It's subtle. And that's the thing about our disease. It doesn't come right up and pop us in front of our face and say, "Here I am." It comes in a very subtle form. So, I want to share that because those three things, if you're new, you know, have been very, very vital in not only keeping me here, but they've been very vital in my whole program. You know, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. It wasn't if you were going to drink. It was when and how good were you going to do it. You know, there was no issue about that. And, you know, I was thinking about this a minute ago. Alcohol actually worked for me before I even tasted it. Because, you know, my daddy was one of those guys, if he did not stop at the tavern, you know, he was restless, irritable, and discontent, man. And I was the oldest of 7. And we would sit there and wait for him to get home. And if he hadn't stopped by the tavern, he'd come in. The first thing he'd do, he'd pop the cabinet open. He'd get that Yellowstone whiskey, and he'd shoot it down. And then he'd get this beer, and he'd guzzle that beer. Almost drowning myself. But then his head would come back and go... And I was 10 years old. I went, "Man, that felt good." And I remember thinking, "I don't know what just happened there, but I'm getting into that, you know." Couldn't even taste it, but I saw the relief in his eyes. I saw the relief in his face. And after that, you know, we could have fun with him. We could play with that for a while until it got to the other end of the thing. You know, and the other thing about that family, too, just to give you an idea, you know, there was a lot of heavy drinking. No alcoholics until I came along, evidently. I figured out one time we had two types of people in my family. You were either a character or you were a nervous person, you know. My dad all the time would talk about these uncles he had. You know, they'd tell stories like, well, you remember that night Uncle Mike came in and he had that shotgun he always had, and Uncle Pat came in all drunk, and Uncle Mike woke up and he shot him. And everybody'd laugh and have another beer, you know. And my dad would say, ah, Uncle Mike was a character. I'd be thinking, Dad, he's a killer. What are you talking about? You know. And then we had all kind of nervous guys, you know. We had all kind of nervous people. So characters, nervous people, and I became the first alcoholic. Truth was, you know, as you might guess, an Irish family. I was Irish both sides, so didn't have much of a shot, you know. There was a lot of drinking. People were dying of the disease of alcoholism, you know, and that was a fact. You know, my grandfather on my mom's side, I remember one Thanksgiving I was sitting there, you know, watching the football games and looked out. Here came Pawpaw. You know, he parked his old blue Nash out there, and I saw him come swaggering through the front yard, came through the thing, came right over, fell over the lamp right into my lap. You know, I had Pawpaw sitting there, and about that time my mom comes in, grabs him, takes him back in the kitchen. I hear him yelling at him, and but I remember afterwards talking to my dad. I said, Dad, what's the deal with Pawpaws? He said, ah, Timmy, your Pawpaws was in World War I. You know, when he was over there, he got gassed real bad. I thought, yeah, that Yellowstone whiskey's gassing his butt. That's about it, you know. But that was the type of environment that I grew up in, to just give you an idea. You know, and I really, for many, many, many years, thought I drank like everybody else, you know. And then you figure out, you know, if you stay around people just like you, it looks like you're drinking like everybody else. The first hint that I had that there may be something different about that, I started dating a girl from the other end of town when I was in high school. I grew up in the west end of Louisville, and I dated this girl in the east end. And I ended up marrying her, but for many, many years, my excuse was, well, it was obvious that people from her end of town did not understand how people from my end of town drank. Pretty simple deal. And I knew it was true because the first time I went up to meet her family, listen to this, it's going to get you a little, some of it's going to hurt you right in the gut. Her daddy meets me at the front door, and he said, hey, Tim, I've been wanting to meet you, buddy. He said, how about if we go back here in the kitchen and we'll split a beer? I said, what? He said, yeah, we went back in the kitchen. He took a bottle of beer. He put half in the glass and half in the bottle. He said, you want the glass or you want the bottle? I thought, I want to break your neck, you goofy, you know. You know, I screamed at my wife all the way home. You know, I said, what is wrong with him? He really needs help, you know. People don't split beers, you know. 6 weeks into my marriage, see if you can relate to this. I remember her mother out of the clear blue. We were at one of those Sunday picnics. You know, and her mother looks at me and said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure, go ahead. She said, that's your 16th beer. I said, yeah, so what? She said, could you drink 16 Coca-Colas? I said, well, no, you'd get sick. She said, could you drink 16 glasses of water? I said, well, no, you get bloated. She said, well, then how can you drink 16 beers like that? You know what? I thought about that for weeks. I remember going back to work the next Monday going, I don't know. You know, maybe the hops metabolized different or something. I don't know. You know, the truth was I didn't care. You know, I liked what it did for me, you know, no matter what I told you. You know, and sometimes it's interesting. We laugh at it today, but the delusion, you know, that we lived under, you know, and a cave that we lived in, you know, and that small world that we lived in sometimes, I just, you know, shake my head that it could have been like that, but I know it really was. You know, I'll share from you from here that from this point, you know, alcohol will start to take from me everything that will ever mean anything to me. One of the things that I could do, I was a good athlete, and I became an all-state basketball player in the state of Kentucky. And in Kentucky, basketball is big, and so that gave me some notoriety. It gave me some sense of being. Because, you know, other than that, I was a 6'4", goofy, pimply, afraid of girls type of guy. You know, I was all of that that you hear us talk about. But I could shoot a basketball in a net. And because of that, my name was in the paper. My picture was in the paper a lot. And, you know, so that's who I was. And the only reason I'm telling you this is because this alcohol will very quickly take this from me. And it was really the only thing that I really had any self-esteem about. And I got a scholarship to Division I college. He mentioned St. Louis University. And in my family, that was a huge deal, because not only was I the first one to go to college, to go on a scholarship with a lot of fanfare, that was a big deal. And I left Louisville in all my glory in 1966 and went to that Division I school. By the first game of my sophomore year, in those days you couldn't play as freshmen, but by the first game of my sophomore year, I showed up so drunk to the first varsity game that the other players had to hide me on the end of the bench so I wouldn't get thrown out of school. You know, this is like Georgia Tech or Georgia, you know, or the University of Louisville. You got a drunk, dead drunk kid on the end of the bench. You know, and the deal was, I looked at that one time, and this is real important to the rest of my story too, and thought, well, how did that happen? Two things were involved there. I was walking down the street after class that day, and a guy said, hey, you want to go get a drink? And I said, well, yeah. You know, I always said yeah, and here's the next part. My mind always said this. The plan was, we're going to go get a couple beers, come back, I'm going to take a nap, get up, take a shower, and go to the game. You know, I never drank two beers in my life. The problem is, as some of you well know, I had a mind that always told me that's what we were going to do. As you might guess, I drank all afternoon right up to game time. You know, went right to the men's locker room. There's nothing more obvious in a men's sterile locker room than a drunk. You know, they picked me out pretty quickly. The other part of the tale is, 2 days before, the coach had told who was going to be start the game, who were going to be the first substitutes. I wasn't one of them, and it hurt my feelings. You know, it hurt my feelings. And when little Timmy's feelings got hurt, little Timmy liked to drink, you know. And the real thing is, and here's the point I want to make to you that kind of strings to the rest of my story. I have this peculiar character defect, and this is what it is. No matter if I'm on a team or if I'm in a relationship or I'm at work, sooner or later, I start to notice that I'm not getting the respect that a man of my stature should be getting. It just gets me all the time. You know, it has my whole life. Believe it or not, I even start to notice sometime, Liz, I'm not getting the respect a man 16 years sober in AA should get. But you know what? Nobody in AA cares. And that was good news for me, because you guys were real clear. You said, hey, Tim, if you want what we have, if you want what we have, come on in. If you don't, next meeting, next going down the street, you know. But again, that particular night, that was also an element of that. And again, I mentioned that because that was going to be an ongoing, you know, scenario in my life. You know, as you might guess, the basketball came to a pretty abrupt end. I was done by my junior year, and I had become a daily drinker. You know, by that I mean I was willing to do whatever I had to do on a daily basis to get alcohol. So if I had to steal, I stole. If I had to take tests for people, which I did that. You know, my nickname at that time in the college was the Vagabond. You know, there's a great nickname for a 19-year-old kid. I got that name because I was already living the deal. I was living from home to home. And the real truth of it is alcohol was dictating by this time who I was with, what I was going to do, but in particular where I was going to end up on any given day. And it might be your house, it might be your house, it might be under a tree. It didn't make any difference. You know, the deal was on. Alcohol was now, you know, ahead of everything that I'd ever cared about in my life at that point. You know, I came to 1970. I started there in 1966, and as crazy as it was, my grades were awful, but I had enough credits to graduate. And in 1970, if you go back to 1970, and some of you could, there was only two things in 1970 you could do. You could go to work, or you go to war. You know, I wasn't kind of interested in either one. I kind of wanted to keep the party going if I could, you know. And, you know, at that point in time, Vietnam was not the most enticing place for any of us. My lottery number was 6, you know, so I had some decisions to make. And I remember thinking, when you're a young drunk, you know, I only had so many options to get deferred at that time from the lottery. You could do two things. You get married or you go to grad school. Well, at that time, I thought getting married was an awful drastic move. So I came up, and I want to mention this, with the plan for my adult life. And this was the plan that was going to keep me out of Vietnam and just rocket me into stardom. And what I decided was I was going to become a lawyer. And what I did, I went to, and actually the whole plan kind of went like this. I'm going to go take the law test, you know, to get into law school. I'm going to go to law school, graduate from law school, probably run for Congress, and then maybe President of the United States. You know? Now, there's two things involved there. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you understand one thing. It's a quick trip from street drunk to President of the United States. I can get there pretty quick and pretty easy. And so as crazy as that sounds, that's the way I thought. I went and took the test, and as you might guess, I haven't been a daily drinker for the last 4 years. I did not do very well, and I got turned down by the law school. And now, as meager as it was, you know, but it was my life, you know, I saw my life on the line because it was Vietnam or Vietnam or Vietnam. And I remember thinking one day, Tim, you better come up with a new plan for your life, buddy. And I said, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to hire a tutor. I'm going to study for that test. I'm going to pass that test, get into law school, graduate from law school, Congress, President of the United States. For the next 6 weeks, I did not drink a drop. And that's the first time I'd been a daily drinker now for 4 years. I mean, this was awful. I mean, I got the shakes, and I'm hating this, but I'm thinking, you've got to do this. You've got to pass this test. You've got to get into law school, or you're going to die over in Vietnam. 6 weeks, not a drop, painfully. Came down to the day before the test. Test was on a Saturday morning. It was a Friday night. I made a slight change to my plan. The new plan was this. Okay, I'm ready. I shut my book. I'm going to go out, have a couple beers so I can relax, get up, get a good night's sleep, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. That was the plan, a little bit of change. That was a Friday afternoon. I went for those two beers. I did not get back to that campus till the following Tuesday. Found out later on I rode around St. Louis on a city bus, blacked out for about a day and a half, evidently. You know? Physical allergy, mental obsession, didn't know anything about it. Certainly didn't know anything about phenomenon of craving that we talk about in our book. Because here's what I want to tell you. If you'd have given me a lie detector test that day with my life on the line, and you'd have asked me, Tim, are you just going to get two beers? I would have passed because I would have told you to, and I would have passed the lie detector test. And I would have passed it many times, see, because I had no idea about this physical allergy, mental obsession. I had no idea about phenomena craving until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and read that in Silkworth's chapter. You know, what a great knowledge. Boy, does it ever explain a lot to me. You know, the interesting, let me tell you a little side story on that particular deal about 2 o'clock that morning after I went out drinking, I realized I wasn't going to take the test. I went back to the dorm and I paid a real smart guy I knew $20 to go take the test for me. In those days, you could do that a lot easier than you could now. So I go out and stay drunk for 3 days. He goes and takes the test for me. I didn't think any more about it. About 3 weeks later, we got the results of the test this guy took for me. The guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. I think, let's say 800 was perfect. He got like a 799. I had gotten like a 300 on the one I took. So now I got two scores in my name, 400 points apart. And I remember just chewing this guy's rear end out. You know, I said, man, I give you a job. Look what you did to me, you know. But anyway, I remember here I am now. Here's where I've gotten to with my alcoholism. I'm 23 years old, and I thought, boy, I better get to them before they get to me. And I made an appointment to go see the dean of the law school. I'll never forget this day because I walked in there, and this man sat there. He didn't ever said a word the whole time. And I did what you have to do. I started to lie, you know. And I said, well, dean, you're probably wondering about the difference in them two scores. And he just looked at me, and I knew that he knew I was lying. But I said, well, see what happened at the last minute. I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer, and I let this other guy take the test. How'd he do, dean? As if I didn't know, you know. And the man never said a word. You know, here's what I wanted to share. I don't know why I remember this, but I was 23 years old, and as I spun around in that office, that moment, that day, I had a moment of clarity. Because what went through my mind was, Tim, you know what happened. You know what's responsible. It's the booze, Tim. The booze took the basketball, and the booze took your chance to go to law school, and you know it. You know it. You know, and that did not last very long. You know, I walked out that dean's office, ran into two guys I know. They said, you won't get a drink? I said, yeah, let's do it. That's 1970, and I was off and running for another 20 years, you know. And I said one time to an old-timer, I said, how come I didn't get it then? And they said, he said, Tim, it doesn't work that way. You know, you get it if God lets you get it, you know, when he wants you to have it. And obviously, that wasn't your time. So, you know, here I was. I snuck back to Louisville 4 years later. I had left in all my glory in 1966. And I slinked back in really a lot of shame because here I really, the truth of what happened was I got caught cheating trying to get into law school as a direct result of my alcoholism. And you know what? Till I got to AA, nobody in the world knew the real story on that except my mom. You know, thank God for moms. But yeah, I lived with that lie. So here I'm actually coming back to Louisville and starting my adult life on a lie. You know, and that's the whole deal, isn't it? With what our whole deal is about. Isn't our whole recovery program about cleaning up the lies and the distortions of our life? You know, and being able to live on the fact that the truth can be good enough. You know, thank God for that. What a neat feeling that is to have. But I come back to Louisville and I got into teaching and coaching. Now, teaching and coaching is not the best place to be if you're a young budding alcoholic. You know, I mean, that's a tough job if any of you are teachers. And I taught all boys Catholic high school, you know. And I was the dean of students at this school. And that meant, it's like putting a drunk in charge of discipline. You know, there you go. So I was the guy in the morning you had to check into, you know. And I remember this one particular day, and I'm sharing this story, and there's some people in this audience that will know this young man. But I was sitting there this one morning, man, just hungover as I was, trying to get through those first couple hours, you know, big old tomato head just throbbing. And, you know, I'm sitting there just holding on. And I look up, and this is back in the 70s now, where all the kids are, you know, they're out in the parking lot hitting a few doobies, you know, to get ready for class. And I look up, and here's this kid standing up over me. He's got his army jacket on as they wore back in the 70s. His hair was down to his shoulders. His eyes were all glazed over, and he's kind of floating over my desk like this. And all of a sudden, he looked down and went, hey, Mr. Highland, looking bad, dude. And I think I said something like, hey, by God, I'm in charge here, and don't you forget that. There's lots of stories, but there's lots of stories like that. The reason I like to share that particular story is this. That kid, that day, just recently, a couple years ago, celebrated 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that great? I went down to see him several years back when he was first getting sober. And by the way, let me tell you, not only is he 20 years sober, this kid who could hardly read and write, I'm serious, when he was in school, is a multimillionaire down in Florida. You know, I went down there a couple years ago to visit him, and when I got off the plane, he ran over to me and said, hey, coach. He always called me coach. He said, coach, come here, man. He said, look, my kids are over there. He said, I ain't never told him about how I was now. He said, I'll make you a deal. You don't say anything about me, I won't say anything about you. And these guys from Florida know who I'm talking about. He's just a neat young man. And, you know, it's interesting. I was telling these guys at dinner, I taught and coached for 10 years. And this past year especially, I've had five of those guys that I tried to teach and coach come into Alcoholics Anonymous this year. And I got to be their sponsor. You know, and such a neat deal, because what I have found in our program is God gives you a chance to redo. He gives you a chance to redo so many of the areas of our lives that we messed over. And that certainly was one of them. And so I've had a great, great ride with that. But while I'm on that point, let me share this with you, because I think it's a vital, vital thing to share with everybody in here. About 7 to 8 years ago, I had one of those kids, as I call them, they're no longer kids, but one of those kids that I taught and coached came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not only had I taught and coached him, I had known this kid since he was a baby, because his family lived two streets from mine. They had eight kids and kind of grew up with our family. And he was 10 years younger than me. But he came into AA, and I became his sponsor, and we had a great time. You know, for about 2 years, we ran the meetings. We did the deal. You know, we did the steps. And then, all of a sudden, I didn't see him very much. You know, all of a sudden he wouldn't come to the meetings. All of a sudden he wouldn't call me. Once in a while he'd stop by my office and I'd say, Chris, what's going on? He'd say, oh, Tim, I'm okay, I think. I'm not doing many AA meetings anymore. But what I am doing, Tim, I'm working in the Big Brothers program, you know, and I help these little kids. You know, it's a really valuable thing, Tim. It almost does for me what AA does for me. And I said, Chris, let me share with you what the old guys have shared with me. I'm a drunk, all right, and I need to be around my own kind. I'd really like to see you come back around the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying the Big Brothers is not a good thing. And he didn't do that, no matter what I said. And what happened to Chris was his life took a turn, as all of our lives do. And what happened to him, he had a baby by a woman, and for the first year of that baby's life, he raised it all by himself because she didn't want it. But in the second year of that baby's life, she came back and made the courts give her that baby, and she would not let him see the baby. All right, and he started what our book talks about, that obsession of mind that you can so see in that spiral of depression, that spiral of desperation. And he started stopping by my office, and you could see it happening. I started trying to get him to get to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had other guys talking to him saying, Chris, you're going to see that baby again. Well, what I want to tell you is that, you know, he never did get back to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He called me one night. It was the day before St. Patrick's Day, and that's the reason I remember it. Late one night, he said, Tim, something has to be done. I can't do this. And I said, Chris, why don't you and I get together tomorrow and get on our knees and we'll do the third step, you know, because that's all I know to do. Let's turn this thing over to God because that's the only hope we have here. Well, that never happened because about 1:30 that morning, I got a call from another guy I sponsored, and he said, Tim, I'm at Chris's house and he's dead. And I went over that night, and I want to tell you what I saw. I'd known this kid since he was a baby. He was 6'2", blonde, good-looking kid, great athlete. And I walked in his backyard, and here's what I saw. I saw this picnic table sitting there in a chair. He was sitting in the chair, dead. Underneath the chair was an empty quart of Jack Daniels, and in his lap was the hose that came out of his exhaust. And I stood there for a minute, and I wanted to share with you what went through my mind. And maybe this is an opinion, but I like to share this because it means so much to me. You know, I don't care if the world lets me be the deacon of 55 churches, lets me be the head of the Boy Scouts of America, lets me be the head of the Mother Teresa fan club, you know, whatever it happens to be. If the world lets me do all that stuff, if I forget first and foremost what I am and where I belong, you can forget about the rest. I really believe that in my heart. You know, because, you know, I'm 16 years sober. I ran into a lot of guys I came into AA with in Louisville. And I say, hey, man, I don't see you at meetings. And they say, oh, Tim, you know, tied up in my church, coaching the Little League. And I think, well, I hope that works for you, man. I hope that works for you because Chris always comes back to mind. You know, I remember going to the funeral and his mother saying to me, and he was the only alcoholic in his family, and she said, Timmy, that's how long I knew her. She said, Timmy, I don't understand. I said, what don't you understand? She said, I don't understand how a living problem can force somebody to pick up a quart of whiskey and force them to take their life. I don't understand. And you know what? I knew she didn't. But by God, I did. I did, and I think you do too. You know, there's a fine, fine line between us here tonight and the people on the 6 o'clock news tonight. Fine line. You know, I truly, truly believe that. And I tell my guys that all the time. That's the only difference. You know, through God's grace and our commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to be here and not on the 6 o'clock news. Because if you've been around long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, like I have, and some of you have been around a lot longer, I've seen a lot of people that I've seen in the rooms of AA on the 6 o'clock news. And if you're on the 6 o'clock news around us, it's never for a very good thing. You know, after I got into the teaching and coaching, I got married to my high school sweetheart, the girl whose daddy split the beer with me. So you probably understand this ain't going to go very well, right? I had to take a drink of water before I start this part. Let me give you a quick capsule of that. This will kind of give you a feel for it. We got married in 1970. We got divorced for the first time in 1983. Back together in 1985. Divorced again in 1987. Back together in 1990. And got divorced 1994 when I was 4 years sober. You know what? You tell people in your office that, they go, what? I just told you guys. Everybody went, sounds okay to us. You know. Oh, only in AA, man. Only in AA. You know, let me say this. What is that about? I'll tell you real simple. It's about alcoholism and everything that goes with it, you know. I love him. I hate him. He's good. He's rotten. Back and forth and back and forth. And it's a real simple deal. If you don't know there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of your relationship, it's an impossible deal, you know. I know that today. And I have a great respect, by the way, for the Al-Anons and the people in that. Because, you know, that side of our disease, wow, powerful, powerful stuff. You know, and what you really had there were two good people trying their best, you know, overall, through all that, to figure out what the deal really was. And that's the best we could do. That was the best we could do. Also, during that time, I had three beautiful kids that were born, you know. And if you're a father, how about this for a gift? How about having your oldest son born on Christmas morning? 1971, that's what happened to me. What a gift. And I missed the gift. You know, I missed that gift, you know, because I was supposed to be in the operating room at that moment when that baby was born to support my wife and to be there for God's gift to me. The best I could do that Christmas morning was be in the hospital in the men's room with my head in a toilet bowl spitting up whiskey. That's the best I could do, you know. And all I could think about was not the beautiful gift God had given me, but I got to get out of here and get to my dad's house so I can get a drink. That's the best I could do. You know what? And I wasn't around for that Christmas baby because by the time I got sober, he was 16, 17, and he was on his way to college. And I remember he says to me, I'm 6 months sober. Hey, Dad, I want to talk to you before I leave. And I thought, well, he probably wants to tell me how proud he is of me that I'm 6 months sober. And we have our little meeting, and I said, yes, son, what is it you'd like to say to me? He said, Dad, I just want to say one thing. I hate you. He said, I hate you, Dad. Listen to this. I hate you, Dad, because all you think about is you. He said, hell, even since you stopped drinking, Dad, all you think about is you. Bye. Man, I was crushed, you know. I was crushed. And I remember going back to one of my meetings with the old timers. There was a guy in our area named Jack Sullivan. Now, if you ever came across Jack, he was a great old timer. And I picked the wrong guy to share this story with. I said, Jack, you can't believe what this kid said to me. And I tell Jack the story, and Jack said, hey, you listen to this, and you listen close. He said, Tim, you will get credibility in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. You will get it one day at a time by not drinking and doing the next right thing. And you know what? That's exactly the way I've gotten it. You know, and if you're new, I know how it is. We want it back right now. I know I did. But here, let me share this with you. You know, when I was 8 years sober, and I was single, which I was quite a bit, that Christmas baby called me from Seattle, Washington, and his butt was on fire, and he was in trouble. And he knew his daddy was different. He didn't know what was going on, but he knew his daddy was different. His daddy listened to him. He had heard his daddy actually helps other people. And he said, Dad, can I come home, and can I live with you? And he did, you know. That's 8 years, 8 years sober. And you know what? And it's still not where I want it with him. But it's a whole long way from, Dad, I hate you. All you think about is you. So one day at a time, guys, that's all we're going to get, you know. I got out of the teaching and coaching thing in the 70s. And because, interestingly enough, I wasn't getting the respect that a man of my stature should be getting. I noticed that again. And in the 1980s, I went into business. You know, I was, you know how we are. I was an entrepreneur. So I bought a building and opened my business. And let me give you a little capsule of the 1980s, because I told you I got here April 12th of 1990. In the 1980s, I already told you I got divorced for the first time from my original wife, as I call her, in 83. Back together in 85, divorced in 87, back together with her in 90. I was engaged to two other women sometime in between there. I was in the nut house three times. I lived 14 different places. I got shot at twice. I got stabbed with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. You know, we're like always the last to know, you know. You know, 1983, when I got booted out the first time, you know, I ended up living with my mom and dad. You know, there's a good one. I used to run into guys I went to school with. They'd say, hey, Tim, what are you doing? I'd say, well, I'm president of my own company. They'd say, no kidding. Where are you living? I'd say, well, mom and dad. From 1982 to 1985, I went through 5 psychiatrists, and that was a real simple deal, you know. I kept them until he started talking about alcohol, fired him, got me a new guy. I was taking antidepressants and drinking whiskey and beer on a daily basis, living with mom and dad, you know. And if you're doing that recipe, I'm going to tell you right now, it's not a good one. It didn't work for me. I don't think it'll work for you. 1985, my first visit to the asylum, you know, couldn't live drunk, couldn't live sober, New Year's Eve of 1985, and my brother Tommy, through God's grace, also is in this program today, but that particular day, he drug me over to our local nut house, which is called, interestingly enough, Our Lady of Peace, and he drug me up there that day, and I want to tell you how I remember that day. I was about as despondent, you know, and suicidal as I'd ever been, if I could have figured a way to do it, but he drug me up there and threw me into the hospital, and they threw me back in this room, detox room, I guess, and sat there for a while, and then his 2 nurses came back, and this is how I remember it. The nurse sat down beside me, and she said, "Well, honey, why don't you tell me about it?" I said, "Okay, I will." Well, see, in 1983, my first wife, she threw me out, with no reason, by the way, and then I got engaged to this other woman and bought her this ring on consignment, and she took off with that. And, you know, oh, yeah, to tell you, my daddy went to prison when I was 12. And, you know, I just started laying all this stuff out. And I noticed, I don't know how long I was there, but I started feeling better, you know, as I was talking. Looked at the nurse after a while. She didn't look so good. And I don't know how long I'm there. Maybe an hour or two. But I'll never forget this. She looked me right in the face and she said, "Well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do." And I thought, God, what was I thinking? You are so right, lady. You are so right. The problem's not me. It's you guys. It is you guys. If you had people do to you what they've done to me and mess over you like they've messed over me, by God, you'd drink and be depressed too. I was cured. I hadn't been there 2 hours. I spent the next 16 days in the nut house kind of helping everybody else, you know? I did. I thought God sent me there on a mission. I really did. They made me head the stress class. I got the blue ribbon for the best ceramic. You know, I mean, I thought I was going. You want to hear real insanity? Real insanity. About halfway through that stay in the nut house, they say to me one day, "Would you like to pass out tonight?" I must have thought they said, "You want to pass out tonight?" I said, "What?" They said, "Yeah, you're doing great. If you want to go out for a couple hours, as long as you're back by curfew." I thought, well, that's great. I call my best buddy. He picks me up at the nut house. We go right to the watering hole, man. Slam down 6-8 beers, a couple shots of whiskey. Got us a big old bottle of wine. I'm telling about all the people I'm helping back to the hospital. Crazy. And being real responsible, I looked at my watch. It was 10:45. I said, "Hey, I got curfew to the nut house. You got to take me back." So we pile into the car, drunker than Cootie Brown, you know, and he takes me back to the nut house, and he's driving. I get out, getting ready to get out of the passenger side, and I look back at him. He's got tears streaming down his face. I said, "What is wrong with you?" He said, "Tim, you don't belong in there." "I do." And I think I said, "You know what? I think you're right. And when I get out of here, I'll help you." And you know what? You know what? That's 1985, and I came out of there, and I did what I always did. You know, I started over. I got me a new girlfriend, got me a new place to live, got me a new business partner. I was always starting over, man, always starting over. And you know what? If you listen to our stories real close, we're the best starter overs in the world. We don't finish much, but we can flat start over, boy. And the story goes, I got back 1987 with my original wife, as I call her, and it just got worse. You know, we tried to change everything. We got a new house, you know, changed the geography. And as you know, wherever you go, there you are. It not only got no better, it got worse and worse, and she threw me out of there again and right toward the end of the year of 1989. And I spent my last 6 months of my drinking living in a guy's basement, you know, in the other end of town. And so now I was president of my own company living in a guy's basement. But and all I can tell you there is that stretch for me is you know, I did my deal. You know, I got drunk at night and staggered in there and got to work and I did, you know. But something started to change. And I guess I was starting to God was starting to work in my life. In April 12th of 1990, I woke up like I always do in that basement. And I'm in a business where the phone rings all day and people are in and out of my office. I mean, literally all day. April 12th of 1990, I walked in at 7:30 in that morning out of my basement to my office, and I sat down in my chair. I did not move for the next 4 hours or the next 4.5 hours. And the phone never rang one time, and nobody ever came in that office. And I guess, you know, the book talks about that moment of clarity, because all I can tell you, I had this sense that this wafted over me that, Tim, it's over. It's over, and you know what the problem is. You know what the problem is. And I reached in my desk drawer, and I found a directory of the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that a guy had given me 2.5 years before. And it was still there through God's grace. And I went to my first meeting that day, April 12th of 1990, and this incredible, incredible journey in Alcoholics Anonymous began for me. You know, and the first thing I want to tell you right up front about this journey is that, you know, the truth about it is it's been a great ride. But also the truth about it is I've laughed harder than I've ever laughed. Cried harder than I've ever cried. Felt things more than I've ever felt in my life. And I've learned from you people that that's what sobriety is, Tim. You get to be a part of life in full. In full. We were talking earlier tonight or at lunch or at dinner about, my wife used to say to me back in the day, "Hey, Tim, you're not even here when you're here." Oh! Used to make me mad. I say, "What do you mean?" She said, "You're not here even when you're here." See, because I didn't understand until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that not only did I have a physical allergy, I had this mental obsession. And here's how it works. If I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. If I'm not thinking about drinking, I'm thinking about me. God, I love to think about me. I'm just my favorite subject. You know? You know, as a consequence to that, I kid about it, but I missed a lot. You know what? Because I have these 6 grandbabies today. And I don't miss a thing. I do not miss a thing that they do. And I am so mentally and physically involved in what they do, and I don't remember my kids doing these things at all. And the reason is I wasn't there. Because of the disease of alcoholism, either had me bodily absent, mentally absent, and always spiritually absent, you know. And I'm so grateful for that today. And if you, those of you who've been around understand exactly what I'm talking about. Those of you who are new, stick around. Stick around. If you think this not drinking thing doesn't get better, just stick around, man. It's incredible. It's so incredible. And I'm so grateful for that. I want to share real quickly about, I was here about 14 months. I don't want to share it to you new people that, you know, don't do it this way. I hung around Alcoholics Anonymous for 14 months, didn't get a sponsor, didn't have a home group, and almost drank and probably died. You know, and if 14 months, if you'd have ran into me in those times and you said, "Hey, Tim, how's it going?" I'd have said something like, "Great! What's your problem?" And I finally got this little sponsor back at that time, man. I had to do something. And he would tell me this. I couldn't sleep at night. I couldn't think. And he would tell me, "Tim, just remember, God is love. God is love. God is love." And that's how I went to sleep every night. Still do sometimes. God is love. God is love. But I want to tell you what. At 14 months sober, God is love was not getting it done. And I remember this one day thinking, if I call that little sucker and he gives me that God is love thing one more time, I'm going to go get him. And I called him with the issue of the day. And sure enough, he said, "Tim, just remember, God is love." And I said, "Damn it, I know he is. But I'm so angry. And I'm so depressed." And he said, "You're ready." I said, "Ready for what?" He said, "Tim, listen to this. In Alcoholics Anonymous, God is love, but love is action. God is love, but love is action. God is love, steps 1, 2, and 3, your powerlessness, his power. Steps 4 through 9, your simple responsibility to clean up your mess. Steps 10, 11, and 12 keep you in the deal. What do you think, Tim? Are you ready?" I said, "Yeah, man, I'm ready. Because I cannot live in my skin without alcohol. Something has got to change." And he put me in a big book study, and I've been in a big book study ever since. He sent me down to this downtown meeting to find gratitude. And that's my home group today, and I became the coffee maker at the Lambton Baptist Church. And you know what happened to me at 14 months sober? I was in the deal. I was a valid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was finally in the middle. And that's what I want to say to you. If you're new and you're out there on the edges, like I was at 14 months, boy, don't do that. That's miserable. Come on in to where the people are having fun. That's in the middle. That's in the people that are putting this conference on. That's the people that come to these conferences. They're going for it. They're getting in the middle of it. They're getting hands-on. You know, you don't have to wait. You don't have to wait, you know, to come on and get into the thing. You know, the other thing I want to share with you, too, is the most valuable item. When I got here, my life was a little messy, as you might guess, and I had about $250,000 in debt to people who really wanted it back. They really wanted it back. And I used to sit around, you know, days just thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? And I'd shuffle papers from one side of my desk to the other. Of course, thinking as an alcoholic, trying to come up with one big deal, you know, to come up with $250,000. And I went to a meeting one night. And this, I was sharing my dilemma. And this old man said to me, what time does your work start? I said, well, it starts at 8 o'clock. He said, be there at 8 o'clock. He said, what are you supposed to do next? I said, I'm supposed to make my sales calls. He said, make your sales calls. What next? I said, well, I'm supposed to go to lunch. He said, go to lunch. Come back from lunch. So what's next? I said, well, I'm supposed to do my paperwork. He said, do your paperwork. What's next? I said, well, work's over. I'm supposed to go home. He said, good. Go home. Have dinner with your family. Go to your meeting. Come home. Say your prayers. And then he hit me with the big one. He said, and Tim, do the same thing the next day. And I remember thinking, wow, what a concept. What a concept. You know, when I did that, and I want to tell you a sequel story to that, you know, because, you know, what I realized, that's all I could do. My sponsor talks about we do the stitches and we leave the patterns to God. We do the stitches and we leave the patterns to God. See, and that's hard for me because I want to know if I'm stitching, I want to know what I'm making. What do we got going here, God? We got a hat. We got a coat. He said, no, you just stitch and trust this, that God's pattern will be far better than any that you could design, Tim. And you know what I did with my work and that $250,000 with the debt? I just started stitching. I started doing what that old man told me. 8 o'clock, making my calls, staying there, going to lunch, coming back from lunch. Here's a neat little story. 5 years into my sobriety, I came back after doing those stitches for 5 years. I came back to my office one day and there were 7 phone messages. 6 of them were from AA guys. The other one was from the newspaper. So I call the AA guys and talk with them, and then I call the newspaper reporter. And she says to me, hey, Mr. Hyland, your company has been recommended to us. We want to do an article. It's one of the fastest growing businesses of your type in the Louisville area. And what we'd like to do is an article. Could you tell me what you did to turn your business around? I said, well, see, our office opens at 8 o'clock. I try to be there on time. Where, you know, and I went through the whole deal, and at the end there's like silence on the other end of the phone, you know, and I hung up the phone, and she said, well, thanks, Mr. Hyland, we'll see what we can do, you know, and I hung up the phone, and here was the thing, I hung up the phone, and I knew there wasn't going to be any article, I knew that, but I also knew I had told her the truth, I also knew that I had done exactly what that old man had told me to do. I had done what my sponsor said that we all have to do, is just do those stitches and leave that pattern up to God. You know, and that's exactly what had happened. It took me 9 years of my sobriety to pay off that $250,000 by doing those stitches one day at a time. One day at a time. This hasn't been, you know, an easy thing for me. I have a lot of fun, as you can tell, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you can tell, that all that marriage business has not been fun, and it was very painful as it happened, embarrassing, in fact, at times. And yet, maybe some of the reasons are self-inflicted. I remember one time telling my sponsor, I said, you know, I'm having trouble at home. I can't seem to communicate. Every time I say something, we get in a fight. And he said, well, here, let me give you some tools here. Maybe this will help you out, buddy. He said, when she says something or anybody says something to you, why don't you say back to them, well, how can I help? How can I help? He said, that'll put the ball back in their court. How can I help? He said, oh, yeah, and here's another one. And just in case, you might tell them if they don't want your help, you might have to say, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. Sorry you feel that way. You Al-Anons will love this one. So I got, how can you help? I'm sorry you feel that way. And the last thing he said, Tim, validate people by telling them, well, you might be right. You might be right. And, of course, you know, being a drunk, I can't do anything right. So for 3-6 weeks, man, I'm everywhere. Well, how can I help? Hey, sorry you feel that way. You might be right. You know, I'm at work, at home, I'm using these tools way over. Tuesday night men's meeting, you know. Boy, it was a great meeting. I just kind of spiritually am pumped up. I kind of fly home on my wings, you know, how we do. I kind of sail into the house, you know, and I go into the house and my wife's yelling at the kids. The kids are yelling at each other. I kind of float to my, you know, my spot in the kitchen, and I'm sitting there. And as my wife came in, before I could say anything, she said, "And don't give me that how can you help stuff." And I said, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry you feel that way." She said, "You ass." I said, "Well, you might be right about that." All right. I just want to caution you now. Don't tell that. After I talk, sometimes people come up and go, "What were those three things? What were those three things?" I said, no, don't use those things. But anyway, I'm sure they're all good things. Let me share and wrap this up pretty quickly, you know. After I got divorced in 1994, you know, it was a rough deal. And I went on about my way for 4 or 5 years. But then, you know, I fell in love and got married to a lady in AA and thought it was the perfect deal. I absolutely did. I thought, this is great. You know, God has blessed me and put us together. It lasted 8 months. You know, 8 months. And it was very painful for both of us, and it was very embarrassing for both of us because we were both pretty, you know, visual in AA. And I tell you, I was driven to a whole new level of surrender, and I don't know what, it changed me. But that's 1998, 1999, you know, and I just thought, God, just let me, just let me help newcomers. You know, that's all I want to do. No relationships. Interesting thing happens, though, on the way to my bachelorhood. A couple years back, my most frequent wife, as I call her, mother of my children, she called me one day. She said, "Hey, I'm taking the kids to South Carolina for a vacation. Would you like to go?" And I go, "Oh, yeah, I ain't got nothing to do. You know, I'm by myself." And we went, and I went down on vacation with them. And, you know, we started this whole new relationship. You know, we just became friends. What a concept. Friends for the first time. And we've known each other since we were 17 years old. And you heard the story. We started, you know, being friends, and we came back from that, and we started dating a little bit. I had a condo, she had a place, and then we eventually moved in together. And about 3 years ago, we were sitting around, and she looks at me, and I look at her, and she said, "What do you think?" I thought, well, why not, you know? So 3 years ago, on what would have been our 33rd gross anniversary... we got married in our house with our grandkids with a justice of the peace who's a guy sponsoring Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I want to tell you something, you know, we are very, very, very happy. You know, and I said to my sponsor one time, I said, "Is this a little crazy?" And he said, "You know, Tim, maybe not. Because think about this." He said, "If our steps mean anything, if they're about anything, our steps are about transformation." Transformation. He said, "You know the thing about transformation? We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know who it's going to happen with. And we don't know what it's going to look like." We don't. You know, and I think that's true because, you know, whatever our problems were, I think about it sometimes. The stuff that used to bother about me about her and vice versa, I even think someday, why was that an issue? You know, and I think we do change. I think we do transform, you know, if we can just hang around and stay in the loop of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I did do that. And she did do that. You know, let me just share this real quickly. I have to leave. I really love conferences, and I would not leave this one for anything, but I'm going to have to leave early Sunday morning to get back for my oldest granddaughter's first communion at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I really want to do that. I want to tell you a story. Maybe you'll understand why. She's 8 years old now, and she was born in my sobriety and to my son. And about 3 years ago, we took the whole family on a trip to Colorado for a skiing trip, and it was fun, and she was about 4 years old at that time. And I'm up in the condo this one particular day, and all of a sudden I hear this incredible racket, and my son's screaming, my daughter-in-law screaming, and I run in there. My wife wasn't there at the time, and what had happened was this little bitty child, and she's a tiny little thing, had lodged something in her throat. I mean, really lodged it, and they could not get it out. They could not get it out. And we're pretty remote place. There's nobody around, and, you know, they're beating on her and screaming and yelling. And the next thing I know, I got her in my arms, and we're running down this hall, and I guess we're going to try to find EMS. And all I can tell you is, for some reason, you know, I just dropped with her in that hall on my knees. And some reason, intuitively, I knew that we couldn't make to wherever we were going. And I got on my knees, and I asked God's help, and I don't even know what I did, but I pushed and sucked and pulled, and sooner or later, because she had died. She had died. She had gone purple. Her eyes had rolled back in her head. She had gotten totally purple. She was getting stiff. And I just, you know, prayed, and somehow or another, whatever it was, dislodged, and she began to choke, and she came back alive. And they were able to get EMS there, and they hauled her off, and they took her to Denver and revived her, and she's doing just fine today. You know, but I was sitting there, and my son came back. And this is a son of mine, my second son, who when he was 6 months old, I dropped him in a drunken stupor. I dropped him and almost killed him on the concrete one time. But he came back from the hospital, and he looked me up, and he said, Dad, you saved her life. He said, Dad, I am so glad that you're sober. I am so glad you're sober, Dad. You have become my hero. You know, and I tell you what, every time I think about that, you know, and here's what I've often thought about. You know, if I had to bring that kid back in a box, if I had to bring that kid back in a box, you know, I don't know, you know, what would have happened, but I do know this. I would have come back to you people. I would have come back to the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, one way or the other. Because I've seen it. I've been there for other people. I've seen other people go through tragedies. And it gives me hope and faith that no matter what happens, that I'll be okay. So I think you can see why it's important for me to get on that plane Sunday morning and be there for her that afternoon. Because, you know, she loves her pawpaws. She loves her pawpaws. And I'll just finish by saying this, you all, that, you know, there's no beer cold enough. There's no whiskey good enough for me to miss a moment like that. There just isn't. And you know what? I'm looking forward to the rest of the time and meeting a lot of you. If you see me wandering around the hotel kind of looking starry-eyed, come up and give me a hug, because probably what's happened, I'm starting to notice I'm not getting respect at the Friday night's visit.